Welcome to Table Talk. Tonight, we have a spooky podcast for you. I'm John Jones, and I'm joined by Grant. Grant, what's your favorite scary monster?
My favorite scary monster is the mummy, because they're the least scary mummy possible. Like, they're the least scary monster because they're so slow and they're so easily flammable. So I reckon I could beat up a mummy.
I almost thought that was going to go a bit Freudian at the beginning.
And
it didn't.
And I'm also joined by Will Blackstock in London.
Hi, I'm Will. My favourite scary monster is probably the vampire, just because I'm a bit of a vampire nerd kind of guy.
I like you do dress vampires. A bit like a vampire.
People have said that.
A vampire nerd. I like that. That's really good.
I don't know. I read Dracula at a reasonably young age, and that obviously made an impression.
Yeah.
Oh. And also in London, Connor O'Sullivan, our special guest for tonight.
There is no Connor, only Zool. hi, I'm Connor. And my favorite monster, mainly just because I want to antagonize Will, is werewolves. And also because they get away with being scruffy bastards. Ooh. So.
What about you, John? What monster do you like?
Yeah, what are you into?
Slimes.
Slimes?
That's
yeah, I mean,
great.
How do you
Dungeons
fight a
Dragons
slime
monster? Okay, I see what
you
mean.
You don't want it to have a
it's
face.
Still a monster, isn't it?
Yeah.
Liquid nitrogen, I think, isn't it?
I think it's quite apropos because tonight we're going to be talking about mostly role-playing games, I think. The topic that we want to talk about is how far is too far, I think. Connor, you came up with this.
Yeah, I mean, where I was coming from with this is I quite like horror in general anyway, but despite being a wimp. But in role-playing games, I think there's some really good role-playing games for horror out there, and it allows you a lot more freedom than most other media. But the catch is, I think, and I'm not sure if the other guys will agree with this, but it's quite difficult to try and get a good atmosphere going, because at the end of the day, you are still sat around the table or, you know, having a few beers or whatever. And so a lot of times, you know, you're going to try and get a good atmosphere going, and you're going to, you know, bring in stuff that maybe isn't always the nicest of things. Mm. And I guess the trick is, how do you manage that and, you know, walk that line between being very effective and going, oh, no, don't like that at all, and just killing everything for everyone?
Well, the important, what's the word, technique from Nordic LARP. And if any of our readers or listeners are into LARP or into game design, it's really worth having a look around the Nudepunkt movement. That's spelt. I can't. It's K's in it. more K's than you'd
there
think.
There may be an O with a line through it as well.
Yeah.
If you guess at it, Google
yeah,
will
help. Yeah, probably. Or just search Nordic LARP. And there's a lot of very interesting essays about how to handle problematic topics. Because Nordic LARP is doing some really interesting, challenging things in the stories that they're telling. And two of the things they have, two of the very basic ones, these are outlined in them in American Guide to Freeform as well, which was recently released as part of a bundle of holding, are the veil and the line. And you make clear to your players at the start of the game. One, you can discuss what you're doing, and if they're not happy with anything, that's fine. But if you've been working with them for a while, you say the two tools you've got to say you're uncomfortable are a veil and a line. And you can say at any point, I'd like to draw a veil over this. It says, I'm okay with this story, but I'd rather we didn't talk about it anymore. Like, I'm not okay. Say, for example, I wasn't okay with dogs being harmed in games. I've got a dog, I love dogs, whatever. I personally, I don't mind if dogs were harmed myself. But if I was, I could say, I want to draw a veil over the dog torture scene. And so I'm happy to play out, but I don't really want to go back to it. And the other option you have is a line. And you can say, no, I'm drawing the line here. I don't wish to be part of this in any way at all from this point on. I want to stop this scene. And I think traditionally, like with horror role playing, it's seen as the GM's king and the players are just rats in a maze. But if you want people to get emotionally invested in a story, you have to give them some sort of control over it. Mm. And I think especially because they are the characters in the story, and we're not just presenting a full picture to them. So if they have the opportunity to say, you know what, I'm not comfortable, I want to step away, that means they have a pressure release valve. So they don't have to rely on the normal pressure release valve, which Connor was alluding to earlier, which are things like everyone's nervous and then someone cracks a joke.
Mm, yeah.
And that's the thing that I do it, we all do it, because it can feel awkward to role play for any length of time, especially if you're trying to role play a horror scenario. And so to give people the opportunity to say, oh, this is a bit awkward, that gives them the higher tools. Most of the time they're not used, but if you give players those in their arsenal, they don't feel the need to continually release that pressure.
I'm trying to picture this. Like, how would you? It's just because, like, a lot of. I guess the reason I say that is a lot of what works in horror, and Will, you brought this topic up, particularly in other media like films, is the disempowerment, you know. And Connor, you actually mentioned PT, which is the sort of demo of this upcoming Silent Hills game from Hideo Kojima. And, is it Del Toro is involved in that? Or is he
Guillermo Del Toro is involved as well, yeah.
What a team.
Oh my God. Yeah, I've had trouble after that, really. I'm okay with you guys talking about it, but just, you know, yeah.
But in Silent Hill, historically, the disempowerment is what drew a lot of people into a game like Dark Souls or Demon Souls, that sense that, you know, you're not a badass, you know.
No, and that's the thing. Like, I think that your mechanics of your game and your story tropes can focus on disempowerment, but the fun part about Dark Souls is actually exerting your will. The fun part is that the fact that you are powerless, well, you're very low power, but through skill and repeated attempts, you do succeed, and it feels great when you succeed. And I think the reason why Dark Souls and horror gaming in general is fun is because it's fun to play at being scared. It's fun to play at being in danger. And having the ability to say, this is actually not fun for me anymore, means that you can leave yourself in this really lovely hinterland. Oh, actually, this is quite scary. Oh, I hope this guy doesn't see us. Oh, that gives you the opportunity to, like, the disempowerment is still there. Your character is not empowered in any way. When you say, I can't handle dog torture in any way in my game, your character doesn't immediately solve the investigation. Your character is still powerless, and it's up to the GM to come up with some other way, to come up with some other story they can tell and some other direction for the game to take to deal with your problems. And similarly, if your entire game is about dog torture, then that's something the GM needs to discuss with you up front.
That's a grim game if that's the case.
I've actually, that's the adventure in the back of Unremitting Horror has quite a lot of dog torture.
Really?
Oh, it's like, I'd say it was about 20% of the adventure.
What? Why are you torturing the dogs? Do they have information you need?
Bart's captain. He's not telling us anything.
This is a really horrible episode of
Where's
Scooby-Doo.
The bone? Where's the bone?
Roll, Raggy! You
four-legged bastard.
Raggy, roll!
But no, that takes us neatly back to, well, maybe not Scooby-Doo, but that takes us back to, like, Connor's original thought, which is, you know, how far is too far? Is that specifically for a group, like, you know, someone is particularly scared by something?
Or I guess if it's a group that you know for a long time, and you hang with them and you game with them a lot, then you chances are you're going to know certain things that are like, yeah, that's not really a topic you're going to cover here. But there's also the
as well.
Yeah, I think you should. I mean, for example, this is a slightly different type of thing, but I mean, John and Grant and I ran a Geist game over Skype a while back, and one of the things at the start of it was to do with 9/11, and you know, personally, it doesn't, you know, for me it's not a thing, but obviously I'm going to check and say, look, this is a thing that's going to happen, and Geist as a whole, I mean, it's about death, so you're going to check and see, is there anything around this topic you want to avoid, or is there anything, any painful things like that you want? So there's definitely that, but I guess the trick is with some horror games is some of the nature of it is that the players aren't going to know what they're walking into. So, you know, you know, you're walking into a scary house, but just on the off chance, are any of you disturbed by guys with, you know, chainsaws for eyes? And, you know, because you're going to give it away a bit, you know, so... I do like the veil and the line. I mean, even something as simple as putting that on a card and leaving it at the center of the table, they can point at it or something.
Yeah, I think, like, what they recommend is having a big X on a card for the line. You just point at the card, and you don't have to say, you know what? No, I'm not interested in this. Yeah. Stop everything. You can just say, you can just say, we need to stop this. And you're respected as a player by the GM that your feelings are important enough to hold this back. But I mean, I'm saying that I've had a great time really, really, really scaring players. One of my players in a Pathfinder game I ran was scared of spiders, and it was a spider-themed game. I hadn't told her. It was a horror spider scenario. And like, we've got fucking egg injections going on and stuff. It's really horrendous. And she's getting creeped out, but she seems to be like, it's not that she's enjoying it, but she's not like, oh, I'm sick. I don't like this. I have to leave. She's enjoying playing with that fear in a safe space.
Mm. Yeah.
And I would then sort of pick on her and have like the spider lands on you, and then sort of go around behind her and put my hands on her shoulders to freak her out. And, you know, and then I started sneaking spiders into her hair and her food, and then she left the game. No,
it's got weird.
Lots of things didn't happen. But she's that was fun, I think. But I think as grown ups, the important thing we can do is just discuss it and say, listen, here are the major themes. And I think rather than saying just on any odds are you scared of guys with chainsaws for eyes, asking your players up front, what aren't you into? What don't you want to tell stories about? I don't want to tell stories about rape. I'm not interested in that. Yeah. I mean the rule I have is nothing fucks anything else on camera. I'm not interested in that. And as I've grown up, we've had like players and NPCs and relationships and stuff like that. But it's that's not a thing I want to discuss. It's not a thing I want to explore in my games. I'm not comfortable talking about it. And so far, I've had GMs who respect that, which is good.
Yeah, just as an aside, I mean, I've been sort of catching up on a lot of my sort of M.R. James horror lately. And he obviously came from a different time. He was a contemporary of H.P. Lovecraft, if you haven't heard of him. But he felt, you know, categorically, he's written, you know, about his ghost stories and just felt like sex had no place. And I guess a lot of his contemporaries in America didn't necessarily feel that way. You know, they were more, and I think that, and that's something in American culture too, especially particularly in cinema, of this sort of, there's always sort of this sexual element, and particularly in the idea that sex is bad and you're going to be punished for it, you know, quite cleverly lampooned by, was it Cabin in the Woods?
God, what a great film.
Oh my God.
Let's not spoil it, everyone, but if you haven't seen Cabin in the Woods, it's the horror scenario you wish you ran. It's the best way I can describe it.
Basically.
It's so true.
So true.
But it's true. I mean, it is true though. I've not read a lot of Mr. James's works. But our M.R. James's works. But yeah, it's very much kind of sedate and very effective, but very, very kind of restrained almost. Whereas a lot of what you play, and I think a lot of role-playing games scenarios are very much more in the kind of American almost slasher style movie.
Yeah.
You know, oeuvre, if you want to go down that road.
Or more, I'd say like X-Files as well, because investigative horror is a massive genre in role-playing.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a great book by, it's very hard to get a hold of because I don't think it's in digital or anything, but Kenneth Haidt wrote a book called Nightmares of Mine, where he, I think it was for Rolemaster or something, but it's kind of, it can be applied across systems. It's more sort of general ideas about horror tropes, particularly in role-playing games, but I think it works from just a story perspective as well. But he kind of breaks down what he feels the components of horror are. There's terror, there's dread, and there's gore. And those are the three sort of main components that sort of he feels comprises horror. And I tend to agree.
Yeah, it's terror, dread, and horror, I think. Terror and horror are very different things. It's lovely to try and break it down that way. So I can just like steer the conversation back briefly to the concept of sex and how sex is evil and punished.
Let's not move away from sex too quickly.
I think that fundamentally it comes down to a social weirdness thing, because I'm quite okay to discuss, you know, like all four of us now playing adventurers, cutting off heads and kicking people down wells and electrifying people and whatever. That's fine, because I haven't kicked a person down a well, but I have had sex with someone. Guys, I actually have.
Really?
Yeah, I know.
What's your wife know?
Don't tell her. But that's the thing. If at that point I'm either describing having sex with an NPC or with one of you guys' characters, and it's a bit weird to have Connor. I'm just going to stroke your hair lovingly as I part your legs. It's already really squicky. Rather than
it's just because I don't have hair on my head anymore. So
it's like, Connor, I stab you hard in the throat. Is fine, but for some reason. for some reason, talking about sex and intimacy can be really uncomfortable. And it's like, and also, like, you get the issue, like, what if one player actually fancies another player and they're not into that and they're using the in-game sex as a means of exploring that and sort of getting their joys on that? That's really squicky and weird. And I don't want to support that. And it's such a fucking minefield. It's better just to excise that entirely, which is a shame because there are so many great stories to be had about love and about sex and about passion and about confusion. And that's where something like Monster Hearts is a great game. Monster Hearts, I'm going to put this forward. It's a horror scenario. So it's spooky and why not run a Halloween game? But imagine it's the R-rated version of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the best way I can describe it. The best mechanic I found from it is you don't roll to see if you're turned on, you roll to turn someone on, which means that your character's sexuality is defined by the other players. And you're encouraged to be queer. You're encouraged to keep your sexuality open because when you're 16, 17, you don't know what you want. You don't know what you're into, and you're becoming something else. And like all the characters have this. You know, they're becoming a werewolf. They're becoming a demon. That sort of thing. They're growing into this natural power. And the squick of body horror is just as much a fear of other humans and being intimate with them. And with the great group, with the right group, Monster Hearts could be incredible. But I still do not know four people I want to sit around a table with and talk about having sex with each other.
How exciting could that be with mechanics or not? I don't know.
It works. It's a very clever system.
Each of the characters has what's called a sex move. So it's something you can only do while you're having sex, which is an interesting sort of thing. It encourages you to sort of push the game in that direction for that reason.
Anyway, enough of our absolute horror on the concept of having sex with a human being.
Fluids. I mean,
and they want things afterwards. They try and talk to you. It's terrifying.
Based on all this logic, then, someone who is actually a murderer who would stab someone in the throat would not really enjoy role-playing games that much because they've already done it. Which is just goes to show you how safe the hobby is, you know?
Yeah.
Back in the
80s. Really well-adjusted guys.
Back in the 80s, they wanted to make it like it was, you know?
I'm not entirely sure that, that logic follows.
I think that may be a logical fallacy there, John.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm going to go with it anyway because the message is good. The message is positive.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good branding. I mean, actually, speaking of investigative horror, I mean, notable mention to Lovecraft, I guess, at this stage, because that's obviously a huge industry at this stage, really, isn't it? I mean, between Trail and Call of Cthulhu and
Delta Green's got a new release coming out as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, have you ever found it to be effective as a horror game, though, is the question, I guess, because...
Not at all.
I think it could be. I've always sort of thought that... we're talking about the three types of horror, and you know, you don't want sort of stuff that's very gory because that's not the point. You want stuff that makes the characters and even the players a little bit sort of go, hang on, human beings are tiny and insignificant, and there are things so much older and more powerful than we could ever really fathom. The universe is such an enormous place. And honestly, I was watching a thing about space, you know, the other day, and it's quite a big place, really. You know, what is it like? No, really. It's really far to the sun, and the sun's just one star. There's 50 million stars in the Milky Way, and then
There's more stars than the sun.
Yeah. What do you think is up in the sky?
I hadn't thought about it. Well.
All right. Well, and then sort of 50 billion galaxies that we can observe, maybe some more beyond that. And the distances are also completely vast. Yeah,
and spinning around there. Yeah, these weird demon piping frogs or whatever.
Mm. That is, you know, that kind of the enormity of the world. That's not quite the right word. The enormousness of the world. That's the better word. of the universe is frightening. And if you can get something like that across, you know, in a horror game, you're going to scare your players. And honestly, that's the goal of a horror game. You're not trying to scare the characters. You're trying to give your players, you know, a bit of a adrenaline rush or whatever. Mm. Obviously, you don't, like we talked about earlier, you don't want to actually freak them out or upset anyone, but you want them to feel unnerved or to feel the dread or to feel whatever.
You want to give themselves a space in which they can allow themselves to be scared.
Yeah. Like a roller coaster or something, you know, it gets your adrenaline up and it's like, exciting, but it's safe.
Yeah.
I don't think you've been on the roller coasters where I live because they're not very safe, I'll be honest with you.
They're
pretty rickety bastards. I take your point. A roller coaster is a great example, I think, of it because it is that thing of, I like this, but my fiance is the absolute opposite. And it, just like a roller coaster, I'd happily sit on one, but the adrenaline that she gets from it is a little too much.
Yeah.
And I think horror works exactly the same way.
I think, I went to Alton Towers the first time very recently, and it was a really eye-opening experience going on Oblivion for the first time, because I felt like, I know this is safe. I can see the structures of the park. I can see the safety things. I can see it's run thousands, millions of times before. I know it's safe. However, my lower brain functions are telling me to not do this, because this is so unsafe, and I could die immediately and instantly. And to juggle those two things is really cool. And to give yourself that thrill of exhilaration of danger, but also to have yourself couched in a space that is safe. And that's the fun part of roller coasters, I think. You know, there's a reason people don't get that same thrill by going and getting mugged.
Yes.
At least not so popular anyway.
You've never gone drinking in my hometown, have you?
Roller coasters and people going, oh, I hope I get mugged.
It's yeah. Roller Coaster Joe's is like the local bar. It's got it's like Oblivion, but it's actually only 20 feet high, and then it's good.
Yeah.
Lots of drinks spilled.
No refunds.
Well, back to what you were saying, Will, I think it's difficult with running an H.P. Lovecraft game because most people playing in a Call of Cthulhu game have read a lot of Lovecraft, and so they kind of know what's coming, you know, more or less. Or you have part of the enjoyment of the original stories was the first time you read them, you really don't know what to expect or where he's going with things or what kind of ideas are going to be thrown at you. And I think a lot of that is the genius of his writing, you know. But I think, yeah, it is really hard to convey that sort of cosmological horror, if that's a word.
Yeah. I played in a game of Call of Cthulhu before I'd read the books. And I read up and afterwards, but we started playing Mars and Nyarlathotep. And every so often, the players who'd played before read the books, something would happen, and they go, oh, this is a bad one. Oh, I'm not looking forward to that. Oh, no. And I've no idea what was going on. Yeah. It's like, well, why are you bothered of that? Like, there's a chalk drawing on the wall. Why should we give a fuck about that? And it was really frustrating to think like that they'd been part of a separate club.
So was it scary for them? I mean, I'm not sure.
No, you're scared because it was all fairly blasé because they know about it. It's a bit like when you play a game of Hunter, either the Vigil or the Reckoning, or, you know, play the Vigil because it's better. It's a bit like playing a game of Hunter the Vigil. If you just use the standard vampires and the standard werewolves, then, you're moving through the woods and you hear a howl behind you and a vampire drops out of the trees. It's a Gangrel, it's fine, he's probably just... And you know everything, like, you know about where he's from and what he's doing and what sort of ways he behaves. And they recommend you make up everything, like you completely change everything about all of the supernaturals. And they give you the guides to do that, which I think is important. Once you know about horror, it's no longer scary.
On your Cthulhu thing, Grant. Is it... I mean, obviously it wasn't in your situation, but do you think it's possible to have a situation like where you've got an NPC who's an expert or something, who sees something and gets really freaked out? Like, could that increase the level of fear?
Yeah, tension.
Right? Yeah, tension. Certainly. Like, I think if it was all done in character, that's fine.
Right.
So, if we're investigating something and then a player has that in character knowledge, or has some brush with the occult, and then role plays that well, it's like, no, I'm not going in there, no way, it's just a door, man, no, I'm not going there at all, you go in there, I'm not doing
not
it.
That door.
That's really cool. And like, if an NPC does it, that's fine, but if the player turns and goes, oh, well, the signs, is it?
I've seen the yellow sign before.
This is my first Cthulhu rodeo. Really boring at that point, because they say, well, you should be scared of this, and I'm not going to roleplay it. It's just bad role-playing, I think. But no, certainly, knowing about the setting and role-playing well is great. And if your players are responsible enough to do that, then by all means use it. But all too often, you get the thing that they know about the setting and it stops scaring them because they know what's going on. And like, I'm scared of a vampire who's like, and he's, you know, he's got blood dripping down his face, and he's got a beautiful, pinstripe suit that's dotted with blood, and that's really creepy. But if you say there's a Ventru there, well, I have exactly the same picture, but I'm not scared because I know about the Ventru power structures. And I think that's the that's the kicker. It's unknown. It's the same thing. It's the scale. Like if you start breaking down and categorizing vampires and categorizing the supernatural, then the scale is lessened. You can understand your own place next to them. But if it's just there is a massive conspiracy of vampires that you've only found out about just now, and one of them is going to tear your head off, that's awful. It's terrifying.
Well, it kind of brings us back to Lovecraft again. His
precisely
famous quote was, "The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear, and the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown," which I'm apt to, you know, to agree with. So,
which basically is so kind of ironic that, you know, the games companies and every other powers that be has essentially quantified every single aspect of every single book or paragraph he's ever written, basically, like, you know.
"I prefer to remain and protect those whom you would destroy."
"You are too late. My blood now flows through your veins."
I think it's if we look at something like Night's Black Agents, which is a kind of a vampire horror spy game, the way in which they handle monsters is very clever, in that they say there is a worldwide conspiracy of vampires, and then they have almost a book-length thing, which is, here's how to build your own vampires for your own game.
Right.
That's and cool. there's no default vampire, which means players can't go into, like, they it's understood that vampires drink blood and things like that. But if you're approaching it from that way, that works really well. And I think, like, Call of Cthulhu is definitely the Cthulhu Mythos is a big enough thing to have, you know what, here's some more weird shit. Here's stuff which H.P. Lovecraft never wrote about.
But you're right,
Connor. Like, to distill everything he wrote into a best and everything that his fans wrote about, et cetera, it can become fairly banal once you've... If you're able to flick through a bestiary
and see
how many bullets you need to kill Cthulhu.
And see the scale of each one to each other as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think why it endured, though, is because there were a lot of gaps. You know, he doesn't necessarily, in his writings, fill in every detail. And so there might be not only variation, but there just might be stuff going on that he hasn't described. And also, you're completely powerless against a lot of these forces. You're completely outmatched. Yeah. So even if you know that it's a Byakki that's rapping on the door, then you may have no defense against it.
I mean, that was one thing I think about Trail of Cthulhu, which I liked, which was that near the end, they have the kind of, for lack of a better word, the bestiary of the different old ones. So they have Cthulhu and Hastur and so on. But they have, here are six or seven different takes on what that might be. So, you know, Cthulhu is a great god under the ocean. Cthulhu is an alien from space that happens to be in the water. Cthulhu is actually a kind of a social meme or whatever. And so there's, when you play your game and someone says Cthulhu, the players, everyone kind of knows what Cthulhu is. But in the purpose of this game, is he this or is he that? So it gives it some level of ambiguity. But one thing I'm interested in seeing, I'm going to try and do it myself, but to try and run a very simple Trail of Cthulhu game with people who've never read or borderline heard of Lovecraft and see how that works out.
That would be very interesting to see if the concept even scares them.
Yeah, because what I've done is I've sold it to two friends of mine who loved True Detective, and I've kind of gone, well, this is essentially that, but set in the 30s.
Yeah.
And you know, see what happens. So, interesting to see. Mm. But I think because of that kind of distilling everything down, that fear of the unknown, I think that's what makes, for me, the likes of the World of Darkness Mortals setting, or, I mean, I think there's so many of them. You know, those games that basically... Here's how to tell scary stories, but they don't give you any monsters. They don't give you any, you know, it's just, here's a set of tools, off you go, do your own thing.
Yeah.
Which means that when your players are playing a game, they have zero idea of what they're walking into potentially.
And that's, I think it's important to give the GM mechanics, so you can have, here is a scary monster, here is what you need to do in the game, and you have to try and make up stats as you go, but to give them the opportunity to reskin things, to change things, and to make things scary for their players and play on their own fears is super important. Yeah. Should we go over some recommendations for horror games?
Yes.
Yes.
Like, for RPGs. I'll go first. Dead of Night is great. It is a lovely game. It's by Cubicle 7. It has a werewolf on the cover. It has very, very light rules, and they're not always super intuitive, because your characters are only defined by 8 numbers, for example. But it has a thing called survival points. And survival points are the thing that you spend when you want to not die. And you earn survival points by doing really stupid things. So, like, they're mainly defined by genre. So if, say, in a horror movie game, in a horror movie, it's fairly common that a character with a gun might say, here, take this, and give their gun to someone who's utterly incompetent with guns, kind of balancing out the power levels to keep the drama up. Mm-hmm. And so, and like you might throw away an axe so you can run away faster, that sort of thing. Doing horror movie shit gives you survival points, which you spend to not die. The only way you can not die is to spend survival points, so you have to do horror movie shit. And the more points you spend, the more and more horrific the game gets. There's a little chart that the GM keeps working up. And it starts from, like, oh, you see something and it's just a cat, to you see something and it's a cat which turns into an octopus and tears your face off as you go up. And it just gives players a direct, huge benefit to do very stupid things, which you kind of need to do for that sort of B-movie horror scenario. So from that, it's a really lovely book. It has the way it does sample adventures. It's a generic setting. It's horror. You're telling horror stories. But it has about 20 different settings, and they're defined as movies. So they've mocked up movie posters, and they all look very
cool.
They look like actual posters. And then it talks about them as though they were released, and it's like critical reception, audience reception, and tying into other films of the same kind. And then it's got a little page after that, and here's how to run that in the game. And it just it completely puts you in the mood, because it's got that survival point. It has the sort of the rhythm. It has the 3-act structure of things getting worse and worse and worse and worse until octopus is tearing off everyone's faces. And it's just it's the best horror game I've read. It's really cheap, it's really affordable, it's really easy to run, and it's expressly designed to have to be run as a one shot in to the extent that if you have a returning character, they're significantly worse than new characters.
That's cool. That's really cool,
because they die in the sequel. But yeah, yep. So yeah, play Dead of Night.
Awesome.
That's great.
I've got a recommendation. It is a game which I came across sort of slightly randomly. Very, very simple. It's called We're All Going to Die, and it's a good way, I think, of doing a slasher horror kind of thing. So you'll create your characters. There's a few things you're good at, some things you're bad at. You give them to the GM, they shuffle them up, and they choose someone at random who will be the survivor. And that's it. Like, basically, there are no dice involved after that. You just sort of you tell the story together, and you can explain, you know, using the things you're good at. Well, I'm going to try and survive this way. The GM is encouraged to kind of, obviously, the survivor gets away every time unless they do something really, really stupid. And yeah, the idea is that you don't know whether you're the survivor or not. You're supposed to drop some hints if you're a GM, you know, who might be, who might not be. And you get to the end of the game, and there's presumably catharsis, excitement, all the good stuff you get.
It's a really lovely idea, because, like, the core conceit is you don't know whether you survived because you made the right choice or because you're the chosen one.
Yes.
And that keeps it into that. It's like watching a horror movie. You don't know who the main character is. And it has that. It has the idea. It's like the first act and the first half of the second act of any horror movie is you don't know who's gonna survive to the end, unless, you know, they've had sex, at which point they die. But to keep that uncertainty is really, really cool, and also to have those thematic traits. Plus, it's the sort of game you can play around a campfire, which is nice. Like, you don't need to, like, you play it on a card journey. You need no dice. Yep. You need no character sheets. And I'm a huge fan of making games as light as possible.
John, can you link to that in the show notes, because it's just free. It's like there's no.
It's on a live journal, I believe.
Yeah.
We're All Going to Die.
That dates it slightly.
Yeah.
Oh, God! We're going to die! Don't you understand? We're all going to die!
Connor, do you have any recommendations?
Yeah, I think my ones are pretty basic. I don't play as many RPGs as you guys, but the one that I tend to use if I'm ever doing a horror scenario is Fear Itself by Pellegrin Press, I think.
It is indeed.
Yes. So that's running the Gumshoe system, which is the same as Trail of Cthulhu and Mutant City Blues and so on. And it's essentially investigative horror to a degree, but it's very much more focused on old school horror tropes again. So generally speaking, all your characters have a reason that they're walking into blatantly stupid scenario that they're walking into, be it that they're the junkie or they're the jock or the, you know, that kind of setup. But I think what's good about it is it's just so flexible, really, again, you know, and you've got so much to work with. It's basically just, here's a set of stats and here's a set of
scenarios and off you go. I mean, personally, the book that they released with it, which was Unremitting Horror, if I'm not mistaken.
That's the one with the dog torture in.
This what, sorry?
That's the one with the dog torture in.
Yeah, I must have skipped that because I didn't see that at all. But, I mean, the cover of that is enough to kind of make me go, no, I'm going to put that face down on the table.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I bought it. I would not have it facing me at night in my room.
It's a fantastic resource, I think, for horror games. I mean, it's basically just a series of horrible beings or ghosts or scenarios with fantastic flavor text and kind of stories and narratives and stuff. So, I mean, that alone is resource for a long time, as well as they released a very good one-shot scenario as well called Invasive Procedures.
It's pretty which much is the best scenario I've read.
It's outstanding, and it's set, funny fact, in a hospital that pretty much I worked in as a nurse once upon a time, more or less.
Wow.
Minus the, you know, stabbiness. But fantastic scenario. Well worth... Yeah, well, there was that time. Yeah, but fantastic.
During my stabbing period.
Yeah, I don't like playing it anymore because I've actually done that, so...
Yeah,
it's a bit squeaky because I've done it, so I don't want to do it to other people around the table. But,
it's just messy, you know.
Yeah, but outstanding scenario, really worth playing. If you can find people that aren't too grossed out by, I guess, gore, really, I guess, is the main thing, body horror kind of style
they
thing.
The title, Connor.
You could slightly, actually. That's a very good point, Grant.
Literal invasive procedures.
Do you like invasive procedures? If so, this is right in your wheelhouse. Yeah, so it's very, very good. Very good, indeed. So, yeah, can't recommend that enough.
Yeah, I'm not
sure.
What
about you, John?
I'm not sure I have a specific example. I mean, most of the horror that's happened in games I've played has kind of been incidental. You know, it's not even necessarily a direct horror genre game in itself. And I think sometimes it depends on the circumstances. You know, if you're having a one-shot with, you know, a solo or two players or something, it's actually a lot easier, I think, to make those two people feel like they're alone in the world, you know. But no, I don't, I'm slightly struggling.
Well, you ran Don't Rest Your Head, which I really enjoyed. That could be, I mean, we didn't do it desperately as kind of a horror game, but I think you could.
Yeah, actually. The game is definitely written couched toward horror, and I think it could work really well. You know, I mean, it's just people who are insomniacs and starting to see things that are beyond reality. You know, there's all sorts of great potential. I mean, just written into the book, there's weird policemen with clockwork heads and dogs that are made out of knitting needles or something, and it was really pretty evocative stuff.
I remember, like, the Wax King being really quite frightening.
Yeah, the way it's described, and he's not even really particularly threatening necessarily, but, or at least at first, but yeah, his kingdom of horrible wax people who have been overrun by wax, basically just subsumed and taken over, you know, become his minions. It's pretty freaky stuff.
Have you guys read Don't Lose Your Mind?
No.
Yes, I think it was like an add-on, wasn't it? For
yeah, it's a book of 52 powers for don't rest your head, and it makes the game for me because I found like the core setting was a bit naff at times, and I couldn't quite work out what my power was and what was going on. It felt like it was a bit loosely defined, and then Don't Lose Your Mind was released, and I realized it's supposed to be loosely defined. And every single one of the powers they've got gives you, it's basically a horror superpower because you have it. And the understanding is that if you use it, people are going to get hurt, things are going to go wrong. And my favorite example is knives. You always have a knife. And whenever you reach into your pocket, you have a knife if you want one. And then the problem is you get a knife whenever you're in a threatening situation. An example they give is you get pulled over for speeding, and the officer asks for your license, and you open the glove box, and it's just knives
spilling out, yeah,
and it's
clattering
to
the floor.
It's such a lovely idea. Like no one can ever disarm you. You have access to every knife ever used to kill another human being, and they just turn up in your things. But that sort of power is such a wonderful way of giving players power and giving them a huge slew of horrible complications that come along with it.
That's really cool. Actually, yeah.
One thing I actually want to briefly touch on the idea of that rise and fall. I used to run a game called Zombie LARP. which Will played in. Will crewed out one time. Zombie LARP was a fairly successful, fairly sizable live action role playing game we used to run in an abandoned shopping mall in Reading. We used to get 120 players, and we used to have a quarter of them start off as zombies, and then that ratio would shift. And it was lots of fun. It was a very high action game, and my favorite thing in that game came from giving players the tools to get themselves in hot water, giving them enough rope to hang themselves. And there was a gun called the Tommy 20. And the Tommy 20 was by a company called Busby. And Busby makes shit versions of Nerf guns. And they're very bad. And the Busby was released. The Tommy 20 was released back at the time when all we had were double barrel shotguns and 6-shot revolvers. And what this was, a 20 round semi-automatic battery powered gun. So it fired as fast as you pulled the trigger, and that was astonishingly powerful. But there were two problems with it. There was one, you have to turn it on. So it made a noise like a Hoover when you turn it on, so every zombie around you could hear. And the second thing was, it could fire as fast as you could pull the trigger. If you were firing like normal heart rate, not scared, not running around, not moving at a firing range, you could just squeeze off shots, one a second, you could easily hold off zombies. But you never hold it, you never fire in that way. People would try to fire off 3 shots in a second, they get out the first two, and the second shot would go sideways between the flywheels, which makes it even louder, and makes it a ruined gun. And what we'd do, we'd set it up at the end of corridors with torches shining on it. People would be like, oh, holy shit, the Tommy 20. Oh, we'll get out of here alive, no problems, man. They'd grab it, and they'd go, oh, come on, zombies. Boom, boom, jam. And they'd die. And it was that sensation of, oh, you're so powerful, except you're dead now. That I love that. I love that sensation. And the superpowers do that in Don't Rest Your Head. It's you're so powerful until everything goes wrong. Oh, and how are you going to deal with that problem now? You're powerful, aren't you? And it's like kind of mocking and like showing them something that my friend Chris was talking about in Delta Green. If you want a flamethrower in Delta Green, you just have to ask for one. And then you quickly learn how useless a flamethrower is against everything you're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
It's that sort of thing. It's like, yeah, you know what? Your weapons are useless. Your powers are useless. You're throwing everything you have at this. And it's not that you're that it's just a brick wall that you can't get past, but you've caused yourself so many problems by fighting it that it's worse than if you'd not started in the first place. And that's that true sort of gut-churning, terrible, grim sensation that you tried your best and you've just made things worse.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the really good things about Zombie LARP was the fact that the players actually, you know, had all the adrenaline and stuff for real, because you're running around and these people are coming towards you and they're all covered in fake blood. Genuinely, you can be a bit scared.
I never acted once in Zombie LARP, and it was always like it was real adrenaline and real panic, and like because it's very easy to make someone look like a zombie by splashing some blood on their face. Aside from the fact that our guns were colourful, everything was one for one. Like you didn't have to suspend your belief very far.
Yeah.
And there was a moment. We used to have these things called White Knights, which were like Rorschach from Watchmen. They had that full face mask with the company logo printed on the front, and they're prowling around in these blood-soaked lab coats and massive fucking fire axes, and they kill players. That's their job. They find players, they hunt them down, and they murder them. They're terrifying beasts. You need a full team to take one down. And we're trying to sneak out the mall, and we're hiding until this group of zombies go past. There's about 15 of us in a space about the size of a lift. It's tiny. And this White Knight comes in, and to her credit, the woman who was playing one walked in and stood in the center of us, and we're all just completely silent. It's like, if this thing starts swinging, at least 5 of us are going to die. it's going to kill a third of us in seconds, because it's standing between us and the door. And she came in and just sniffed the air, and then after about 3 seconds turned away and walked out, and it felt like a full hour, those 3 seconds. It was incredible, because the threat of death, like, I was only going to get three goes at playing the game over the course of the day. You've been surviving as hard as you can, you've seen your friends die, you've lost friends, you've made new friends, and then suddenly if you die, then you still get to have fun. But again, you're in that safe space, you're in that, you know what? I'm allowing myself to be scared of the zombie. And I can at any point say, you know what? No, I'm not interested. I'm backing away and just walk out of there. You can leave. But by allowing yourself to get into that and by giving the immersion and everything, you're letting yourself play with that fear. And it's one of the most exciting things I've done, like trying to escape from the complex. while zombies are everywhere, and none of it was real, and I wrote the game. it was still really powerful to give yourself license to be scared. And I think that's the essence of role-playing games about horror. Your players are turning up and saying, hey, scare me. I want that thrill. I want to feel scared. I want to play around with it in a space where I can still go to bed and still wake up in the next morning. I haven't really seen anything horrible. I haven't seen anything that's going to scar me forever.
Can I just say, what a great perk, because like so many people that create things, you know, like directors and authors, you can't sit down and truly experience your work.
I will say, it was just the once, and I wish I'd done it more, because I played the first game of Zombie LARP, and I played the last game of Zombie LARP, and not much in between. I kind of fluked the last game. I didn't know it was going to be the last one. Had we carried on running, I would have put in a thing that every GM needed to play at least once, because it's so exciting to see it from the other side of the thing. And one anecdote, which I'm going to just go into briefly, we always imagine players as being really gung ho motherfuckers, like really hard balls. Yes, kill these zombies. Yeah, we're not scared. Yeah, whatever. Bruh. And just gun grabbing, power crazy bastards. And then I went and played with them, and on my team we had 7 guns. And we each knew how many bullets were in each of those guns. Like we were precisely counting how many, because I knew the guy behind me had two bullets, so he's all right for the first 5 seconds of a conflict. Then we have to move on. Then we have to change. We have to get that forward. And you actually kick up into this really, like being a sort of battle accountant. You enter this new state of being where you are hyper aware of your own abilities and the abilities of your team, and you just start intuiting with each other. I'm going to use the word real. It's so real to have that fear, that panic, that hiding. Yeah, I can recommend doing a full immersion LARP if it's ever possible. And also, don't do these bloody zombie day experience things, because they're all the rage now, and they have been for the last 3 years. And there's no risk involved. You can't die. It's just a haunted house. And if you can't die and there's no risk, and if all a zombie can do is sort of touch you, then that's not very exciting. There's nothing at stake. And to have your pretend life at stake is a huge incentive. But yes, I've been talking a lot about things I've done for a while. I think we should move on, perhaps.
We've done a lot of things, so.
Yeah, I'm an exciting guy with many exciting hats. On that subject, I may have to call it a day, gents, because I have to wear an exciting hat out drinking fairly soon.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, I think we're kind of coming up to the end. I was going to see if you guys wanted to have a parting.
My only thing is, I think we've talked a little bit about this, but don't try and approach a horror role-playing game in the same way you would approach trying to do a horror film or a horror video game, even, because the films aren't interactive in the same way, and the video games, I think maybe there's some more similarities there, but you need to know exactly what you want beforehand and what your players are expecting a little bit as well.
You need to cope with total player agency, which is something which other forms don't have.
Yes. I mean, I think in to an extent you need to sort of corral them a bit, because
of course, yeah.
If they just keep running away from everything, I guess you could keep having things appear, but it's difficult.
Yeah, in Resident Evil, you know, or like in a computer game, the character chooses not to leave, and you have to convince the player not to leave, as it were. You have to give them something which they're invested in. My final closing remark is actually a plug for something I'm doing. Which is a bit cheeky, but there you go. I got my first big name writing gig. I'm writing the new Paranoia edition with James Wallace and Paul Dean. And we're doing a Kickstarter for it. It's very exciting. It's a very cool system which we're setting up. The Kickstarter launches in about a week from now, from when we're recording. So it'll probably be up when you're listening to this podcast. So do search Paranoia Kickstarter, and please give us your money, because I get a percentage of it. I'm not going to say what percentage, but it's a nice... I like money, and I like writing role-playing games. So please make me rich and play Paranoia.
I like how make you rich came first.
That's the thing. I mean, I got into role playing design for the money, because like it's a really lucrative industry.
Pennies from heaven, isn't it?
Bitches love role playing designers.
Yeah, I'm fighting off the supermodels in my Lambo, and they're like, Grant, tell us more about dice mechanics. I'm like, calm down. I've got D20s in my pimp cup. You know how it be. I got my first paid gig, and I'm really excited about it. And I'd love to get my friends playing Paranoia.
Yes, well, I'm looking forward to it.
Connor, cool. Have you got any?
In a word, no. What I would say is, and I'm not saying that I can do horror very well, but if you want to do horror well, the best thing is just to experience it as much as you can. So, you know, no, by which I don't mean like, you know,
come round to Roller Joe's.
It's Roller Coaster Joe's, Grant. Come on.
Sorry.
I don't necessarily mean walk around the darkest alleys you can flashing your bling, but I just mean, you know, watch as many movies as you can. Read the books. I think, to be honest, between books, movies, and video games, books are probably the better resource for role-playing game horror in the sense that they're much, I wouldn't say much better, but they're usually the better one to develop that kind of feeling of dread better than a movie. Because the movie and video game does that very, very effectively, but mostly non-verbally. Whereas at the end of the day, it's language that you're going to be using. So I think books are a much better resource. But try and get to the end of the PT demo as well and see how badly you can be traumatized, if possible.
I think Connor raises an interesting point with actually experiencing fear. Don't go and get mugged. That's a silly thing to say, and we're not going to do it. But remembering the last time you were scared and trying to boil down why. Like, the last time I was scared, I'm not going to go into details now, but I was invested in it, and I knew I couldn't change the subject. I knew I couldn't change the situation to be better. If this boils over, I'm fucked. And that sort of thing, like even being socially scared or being caught in a lie or being trapped somewhere, like when you can't get out or when you can't get home at a certain time, just trying to disassemble that core emotion and what led you to feel that fear, and then plugging, you know, elves and vampires and that shit into it. But the idea of you are invested and you cannot change the situation is the core element of fear, and trying to channel that you're trapped and you can't get home. And that's
let's be honest, some of the scariest things that personally I've ever been through is that situation where you're waiting for someone to call you back and there's no call coming, and there's nothing you can do. But you know, there's nothing overtly dangerous. There's no danger involved in that scenario.
No,
it's
danger
just
to you necessarily. Yeah.
No, exactly. But it's just. It's
and then,
probably,
and then
yeah.
take that and ramp that up so you know there's a killer in the house and you barricade the door and then you can't hear a thing.
Yeah.
And then everything's okay. And you know that you're trapped in there and you know that you've got a little while and the GM just rolls some dice quietly behind the screen. And that, to have that, you've exerted your power, but what you should have done is run away. You should not have barricaded yourself, you should not have come in here. All you've done is made things worse. And that's really the lesson we can take home. Never do anything.
players don't never do anything. Actually do things all the time. It's really important.
It's quite important.
Literally one of your bits of advice from that.
It's the most important advice I can give. Do things all the time.
Well, I think you should just be scary.
Yeah.
Thanks, John.
If you can.
It's worked for me for years.
Do the whole RPG and GM it with a torch held under your chin. You know, the lights can be on and everything, but just as long as that torch is there, that's the sweet spot right there.
I'm actually going to say something else. I'm really sorry. I keep digressing because I'm the one who's supposed to be going. On the subject of torches, Connor, I was once in a Silent Hill homebrew game run using World of Darkness, and the GM bought two shitty Poundland torches and deliberately wore down the batteries. And we were in a completely pitch black room in an ill-converted squash court in the university, and we had to share these torches to read our character sheets, and it was lights out for the entire game. And what he'd done, he gave us an AM radio, and the AM radio was tuned to a certain station. And then on his laptop, he had an AM broadcaster, and he would have it broadcast static whenever we got near monsters or something unnatural, and we got so freaked out, by the end of the fourth session, we turned off the radio.
nope.
And that atmosphere was great. And there's one thing which Connor said, actually, and I'm going to have to go now, but one thing I will say. Hal, my GM, had established such an incredible atmosphere that no matter what jokes we made, no matter how silly we were and how much we goofed off, we were, at the end of the day, sat in a perfectly dark room with faltering torchlight while horrible noises crackled over a radio. And you can only make so many jokes about that.
Yeah.
if you can dress up, if you can dress up your space, you can get, if you can get something which can essentially survive players trying to break that pressure, do it.
Yes.
Or if you can dress up yourself, that's...
Yeah, like a spooky skeleton.
Yes. Or
I was just thinking Magnum PI shorts, you know.
Yeah, I actually like just a t-shirt or like Winnie the Poohing it, as I call it. Just, and like, so you just got your balls hanging out. That would make D&D quite scary.
Yeah. Or,
the gnome welcomes you into the tavern. He scampers about.
Holy like, shit. Is this like where, you know, you just sellotape a small pair of sunglasses downstairs so that you've got a second GM character to play with?
Oh my god.
We back slowly out of the tavern.
The tavern guy is there. He's got quite a big nose. Nope. Sorry. Done.
Go on. He's gone. I mean, okay. As John said, the other thing you can do, listeners, is sexually terrify and confuse your players. Maximum.
It all comes down to sex.
It is sex right back around again.
It's to an action.
Sex is terrifying to gamers. All right. Thank you, everyone. Have a spooky Halloween.
Have a spooky Halloween, John.
Sexy Halloween. Spooky, spooky.
I don't know about you, but I'm having a sexy Halloween. No, thank you so much for listening. Please check out Grant's Kickstarter. We'll put a link to it in the show notes when we can, or we'll put a link to stuff. Yeah. But thanks, everyone. And thanks. I've been John Jones, and I've been joined by Will Blackstock, Connor Sullivan,
bye-bye,
and Grant Howick.
Goodbye, listeners.